and Matan Torah. Because there's a break in the action. And you think that right after Kriyas Yamsuf, which is the sequel, Kitiyas Mitzrayim, let's march towards Har Sinai. That's what it's all about. But Tziachat Samazeh, what's all this song and dance? What's all this drama if we don't get to Har Sinai? So, wouldn't you expect them all to be condensed into one parsha? Yisro sticks out. Why doesn't Yisro append it to Bishalach? So that's a Yisro question. What happens in Yisro that's absolutely crucial for Matan Torah? That's next week. It's also a Bishalach question. What happens in the end of Bishalach that's absolutely crucial for Matan Torah? It's a break in the action. It's like an advertisement, a commercial break. What's happening in Bishalach between Az Yashir, Zekei Levi Anveyu, Hashem Yimloch Le'olam Vaed? I would have thought the next pasuk should be Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Sheretz Hasicha. It's only 6 weeks. I think you're missing a lot of time. So lots going on in the end of Bishalach. Some of the things we're not going to talk about tonight. Obviously, you need Shabbos. We'll talk a little bit about Shabbos tonight. You can't even imagine starting Har Sinai without remembering Bries HaOlam and Shabbos. So that's an obvious one. No brainer there. Also, they're becoming a little bit more liberated and dignified. Remember, it's a quick turnaround, and it's a miraculous turnaround. Vechamushin and Biad Ramah, and just a day or two ago, they were working as slaves and being persecuted. All of a sudden, they're standing, and they're thinking about monotheism. Monotheism is not an easy religion. 6 weeks or 7 weeks is not a lot of time to crash, cram religious ideas. So something has to happen. There's got to be some process to transform these slaves who can't even believe in Geula, Lo Shamu El Moshe Mikotze Ruach, and the people that could stand at our Sinai and hear a voice and translate the voice. They're also learning that faith is not a gimme. And it's an important lesson to you guys at this age, an important lesson to you guys in this world, an important lesson to you guys in Corona. Faith doesn't come easy. Sometimes it seems that faith is so easy and the world is binary and black and white and you feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence and you're leaving Mitzrayim and everything is rainbows and ribbons. Everything makes sense. Then the harsh realities of the Midbar set in and there's no... Caleb, you need a chair? Okay. And there's no food and there's no water and the Egyptians are crashing down and there's a lot of complaints and bitterness and they're steadying their faith. They're learning what faith is. You guys, to a degree, in your life right now, sort of turn this off, in your life right now, you're at that stage where you're trying to make faith long-lasting and permanent. And there are going to be ups and downs. There are moments in which you question. There are moments in which you feel more distant from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It doesn't mean you're not a believer. That doesn't mean that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is casting you out. A lot of people, when they hit that first crisis, and they get angry about something, or they feel guilty about something, they don't understand something about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So some deep psychological reason, they're looking for ways out. Because it's cathartic to release yourself, and it's cathartic to believe that you've been cast away, and cathartic to believe you're an infidel, and you're steadying yourself. It's going to be ups and downs emotionally, it's going to be ups and downs philosophically, ups and downs learning-wise. So there's a lot of ups and downs in Mishal. These are teenage people, they're teenagers. They're waiting to get to Har Sinai. Teenage time is tough. A lot of rocky roads. So a lot is happening between Kriyas Yam Suf and Parshas Yisro. But there's one snapshot that adds a fourth element. Not just steadying faith, and not just Shabbos, and not just transforming their minds, their imagination. They get to Marah, the water's bitter, Moshe plays the tree trick, throws the tree in, and then they get some trial mitzvahs. Because religion is not only belief and concept and value and affiliation, it is riveted to day-to-day, minute-by-minute activity. And that's what makes religion for a Jew so robust, so sustainable, so all-encompassing, and so immersive. And much, if not most, of religion in the modern world is starting to wither and shrivel. Because all it is has been ideas. That's been the Protestant Revolution. Took out all the ceremonies and all the rituals and be a good person, show up in church, and these are the values you believe in. That's what makes, to a degree, Islam much more robust and more sturdy because there are practices and rituals. You can't eat what you'd like. You've got to bow down from time to time. You have to pray. There are rules, guidelines. Christianity, or in most modern forms, not all, it's just become ideas. Well, ideas are espoused Sunday at church, and you get dressed up, and you walk in, you say some nice things to the pastor, to the priest, and it's Wednesday night, and you don't really have a religious roadmap other than some general doing to others, you're doing to yourself, be kind, be... But how do I feel religion Wednesday night when I'm in a movie theater or a basketball game or with my family or at work Thursday morning? What are the road signs? What are the guidelines? What does it mean to be a religious person? So mitzvahs are crucial. And mitzvahs are also crucial not just because they innervate and striate all parts of our lives, but also because it creates obedience and hierarchy. And religion is based in obedience and hierarchy. And so it makes it so hard at this age. How do you become a person who's obedient and not give up your creativity? Not give up your autonomy, not stymie your voice. It can be done. Trust me, it can be done. You have to be polar. Some people feel that religion is about submitting themselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and eliminating any of HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted complete submission. Why did he make you creative? Why did he give you talent? Why did he give you dreams? Why did he give you skills? Some people, during this period, your skills just go off the reservation. You're just so excited by your own talent and your own discovery and your own sense of self and your own ego. It's really hard to feel submitted and really hard to feel obedient. And I promise you, if you work hard, you'll find that sweet spot. You'll find a way to be obedient and submissive and an Oved Hashem and an Abdika Chibrichu and still be creative and artistic and empowered and expressive and individual. It's hard. It's really hard. But the payback is great if you get there and work hard. Don't give up. So they need to have some trial mitzvahs. The concept that they're just going to waltz through the midbar, believing in Hashem, they got it. Har Sinai's coming. And there's 613 on the horizon. And it's going to be hard. So let's have an exhibition season. Let's have a practice run. Mara's a practice run. Have a couple of mitzvahs. Tackle a few. Try them on for size. And then you'll be ready. It's like a shvush. Come to Yeshiva a little bit. Try it on for size a little bit. See what it feels like. And then you can move ahead. Shem, Sam lo chok u'mishpat, source number two. B'shem niso. Kodesh Baruch Hu delivers a few mitzvahs. Trial mitzvahs. Trial balloons. So what are the three mitzvahs, Rashi says? Two make a lot of sense. One is ridiculous. Which two mitzvahs make a lot of sense for trial mitzvahs? Shabbos. I said before, it's seminal, it's foundational, it speaks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu creating the world. A couple of years ago, there was an article in the New York Times, the Holy of Holies, right? So people thought. New York Times, an Orthodox woman described Shabbat, obviously intending to describe Shabbat for a broader audience. And it was just this beautiful, homespun portrait of Shabbos with her teenage daughters in their pajamas. They don't have to go out playing board games. Meaningful quality time, conversation, food, unplugged. Beautiful, right? You've all heard that spiel. You know what Shabbos also is? Bris Olam. Shabbos Lashem. You shut down. And you don't just shut down because you enjoy it. You shut down even when you don't enjoy it because you recall that for all of your skill and talent and all of your ambition and agendas, without Hashem retracting after 6 days of creation, you would be capable of nothing as Hashem would continue to create and continue to. Think about the Shabbos of your great-grandparents. They didn't have Shabbos clocks and heat and ovens and fridges and board games and pajamas with mommy. It was cold and dark, and then limited food options available. And once a week, they experience a shutdown, a total shutdown. It's becoming harder and harder to feel that type of Shabbos because Shabbos is becoming more and more comfortable. So the Shabbos of the New York Times, you've all had, right? We all love the Shabbos, the warm, the time, the unplugged, no cell phones. One time in your life, you will have that Shabbos, I promise you. You'll be stuck in an airport. Or stuck somewhere your plane couldn't take off. Or whatever, you're in a hospital for Shabbos. And you're not going to have your board games and your newspapers and your ragalach and your food and your friends and your kiddush and your kugel and your schnitzel. And then you say, wait a second, Shabbos Hashem. Now it's just me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm shutting down, remembering, V'chulo Hashemayim V'aretz V'chol Tzvam. Remember a few years ago, I was giving this rant to some of the boys on a Friday afternoon. And that Friday night, there was a terrible snowstorm in Yeshiva and the Gush, and we had a blackout, and it was freezing and no food. I said, why did I say that? Shabbos Lashem. So we're freezing and no food. The fridge didn't work. Shabbos Lashem. Okay, so it makes sense. Try on Shabbos once a week. It's not too burdensome. It's like every single day. Once a week, keep Shabbos for a few weeks and see what it feels like on the road to Har Sinai. Makes sense. What's the second mitzvah they receive that makes sense? What? Okay, that's a girsa, but according to the Pasha Dinim, they receive laws of society, civil laws, Maseches Bava Metzia. We take it for granted because we live in a civil world. But the world of civility and law and abiding to law is the world we created. We turned the world from a world of savagery, a world of power, a world of imposing your power in a physical sense upon people, of corporeal punishment, of savagery, of brutality, of the strongest person wins, and might. And we turned it into a world of civil, organized politics, respect for law. Respect for law. I very, very rarely go off tangent into politics, but I saw scenes this week on the Israeli news that you have to know are completely and totally wrong. They're completely off bounds. I'll never give you politics. I'll tell you, I'm always blowing the whistle when you're out of bounds. You respect law, and you respect the instruments of law. And part of that is you never raise a hand against agents and people that represent the law, even if you disagree. Right now, there are some protests that are legitimate and may even support that. They're taking place up north in a settlement called Chomesh, which we're trying to resettle and repopulate. And the army has come and policemen have come to try and implement whatever government policies may be the worst policies. But when you see a soldier, when you see a policeman, you don't act with violence, you don't raise a hand, nor do you create violence. There's something called peaceful demonstration, a peaceful protest, and those are all legitimate. And if you want to protest and be carried away by the police in an orderly fashion, because that's a way to protest and to make a scene, which is legitimate. But once it becomes violent, once it becomes expressing physical encounter and physical struggle, or you cause the physical struggle, even if you're discussing a policeman in New York or South Africa, because you respect law, and the dangers of disrespecting law are far, far greater than almost any agenda that you're serving. Unless your faith and your halacha is at stake, and obviously Harikvel Yavin, obviously you don't buckle, you don't submit. So you have to know where to draw the line. Al achas kama v'kama here in our country where there are policemen and our soldiers. And that's a message you have to hear, and I didn't plan on saying it. It's nothing to do with politics. It could be, I give this message to people of left-wing politics or right-wing politics. I'm just creating ground rules. The ground rules are, we are a people of law, and we respect the law, and we adhere to the law, and we certainly don't create physical, violent encounter with people who are merely enforcing the law. It's not their fault. They didn't decide the policy. They're symbolic of the law. You can disagree, you can shout, you can protest, those are all legitimate. But once it expresses itself in violent interaction, even if you're not the person that is acting violently, but you're creating violent encounter, that is out of bounds. That is illegitimate. And these are very, very troubling scenes to me. And it comes from different sectors. It can come from left wing, it can come from right wing, it can come from Haredi, something like that. It just, that is all off bounds. Whether you're, again, in London, or Sydney, or Melbourne, or Baltimore, or Chas v'Shalom, if you take those actions, you shall lie. Nothing could be worth that type of encounter. So, of course, we are the people of law. We are the people who created civility. We are the people who created civilization. We are the people who defeated anarchy. We don't live in a big lake where the big fish swallow the small fish, because they're bigger. We protect the vulnerable. We protect the innocent. We have due process. That's who we are. Parshas Mishpatim, that's what we're studying. That's the pretext of everything we're studying. We're even studying the whole year. Shnayim Ochsin Metalis, Yachloku, Shvua, Amr B'Yochanan, Shvua Zilamali, Kidei Shalohei Kol Echad V'Echad Holech V'Tokev B'Talisa Shechavera. I couldn't say it better than Rabbi Yochanan. He spent 5 months diagnosing what a Shvua is because Rabbi Yochanan wants to avoid anarchic behavior. Some of you will get to the Gemara Daf Yudim and Amos, the Chachamim Misakin Dalet Amos. Why? The first person to arrive within a 4 Amos vicinity of an item gets the item. Why? Because otherwise people can beat each other up over the watch. I grab it, you grab it, and they tear each other's limbs apart. Chachamim wanted there to be harmonious, peaceful, stable societies. So these make sense. These are at the foundation. These are foundational. Shabbos and Dinan. Which mitzvah of Mara does not make sense? Well, according to some Girsas, Eli, the Mishnah, some Girsas have Kibbutz of Rain. But what does Rashi say? What was the other mitzvah they were given? We go Rashi? Paraduma? Are you crazy? That's the third mitzvah? The try-on for size? Paraduma? Who in the world would suggest or nominate Paraduma as that third mitzvah for trying on religion? This is the fitting room. This is the fitting room for religion. Going out with a couple pants into the fitting room. Why would you take a tennis racket into the fitting room? If you want to see yourself with a tennis racket, see how the tennis shorts look. Why don't you take a blender to the fitting room? The fitting room, take Shabbos. Take Dinim. Paraduma? They didn't have a Mishkan yet. They didn't have Kohanim yet. They couldn't process a Paraduma. You need a Mishkan to process Paraduma. They didn't have it yet. And not only could they not even process Paraduma, they didn't need Paraduma. Because Paraduma relieves Tumas Meis. They didn't have Tumah yet before our Sinai. No one was Tameh, no one was Tar. It's a Halacha concept. You can't be Tameh before Halacha. You could touch a dead body. You could carry Yosef's bones. It doesn't make a difference until the Torah is given and Parshas Emor is delivered and the laws are stated. If you're Tameh, if you're Tar. So they can't process Paraduma. Nor does it have any relevance. Why is that Kodesh Baruch Hu? Why is 613? I don't know. Let's conduct a poll in your mind. What would you say the third mitzvah is? Arayos, maybe. It's important. Sexual laws, sexual mores. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Tefillin, maybe. After all, we just talked about tefillin and Parshas Bo. Maybe tell them to put on tefillin. There's a lot they could try on for size, literally. Why Paraduma? So to understand this oddity, let's read a story about Paraduma. This is my paraphrase of Rav Amital Sichot. This is one of the famous seminal Rav Amital Sichot. Anyone who has COVID symptoms, please follow. Use the door. That's what it's there for. Okay. Anyone's coughing, anyone's got the COVID, long COVID, small COVID, short COVID, slow COVID. I don't know what else COVID's are. Maybe take a little break. Okay. Okay, it's like a graphic, like a commercial. Okay. So, the Gemara talks about the value of Kibbutz Avayim. And to highlight the value of Kibbutz Avayim, the Gemara says, you know who keeps Kibbutz Avayim? Not just Jews, even Gentiles. Any society that respects their elders and respects the family unit will survive and thrive. And any society that doesn't, for different reasons, will crumble. One of the great social plagues afflicting minority communities across the globe is single parenthood. Is dismantling a family. When husband and wife don't live together and raise children, children are psychologically scarred, they lack role models, they lack direction, they end up spending time in the street, falling influenced to negative forces. Communism tried to create a culture without a family unit as well. Let's replace the family unit. Let's take children and herd them into alternate social contexts or social constructs so we can properly indoctrinate them with communist propaganda. Little did they realize that if you emasculate the family unit, society will crumble, society will fall apart. Across the world, Asians have migrated across the world. They built solid, robust societies because there's a healthy respect for elders, very, very prominent respect for elders. And that informs education and tradition and honor and dignity and responsibility and duty. COVID allowing, I'm going to start interviewing boys for yeshiva in a few weeks. So I've got these secret little X's and checks on my interview form. Like if you say something, well, generally you get checks. Like you got express checks. If you say the right thing, you get a big check and you get it automatically. Of course, one of the big checks is if you give me a check. Don't record that. I didn't mean that. Okay, let's put it this way. Tell your friends that if they show up to the Bechina with some donuts, I'm in a good mood. I like donuts. And when I'm in a good mood, we get a lot more people accepted to the yeshiva. So show up with a couple Dunkin' Donuts. Let's just say things are looking up that day. We show up with nothing. There's going to be a lot of blood in the streets that day. So donuts is a good way. But seriously, I got a lot of, oh, he said that. I can't believe he said that. Big check. Very few things you say you get a big X, but some things are like really, really big red lights. Oh, my, heck, could he say that? Big, like, I'm in my little, oh, check into that. Got to inspect that a little more. So one of the big checks is when I say, ask you, tell me a little bit about your family, how many brothers and sisters, who's at home, who's your roommate. Because I live with my grandfather. He moved in with us. Really? You live with your grandfather? You live in the same room with your grandfather? Big, big check. Big, big check. You can get so much from that relationship. So much more than any book or sefer or rebbe or shir or shmooze can give you. Respect, sharing space, tradition, stories from the past. You can't imagine how much you can get. Some of you have the relationship with your grandparents, know what I'm talking about. One of the things I like most, I was actually, we had a little meeting. As you know, Gush is opening a high school next year. So the staff had a meeting with Rav Amichai, who's opening the high school, and they were asking us for input and guidance and our responses and stuff. So I talked a little bit about Chesed. Should we institutionalize Chesed as part of the program or as a side part of the program? And I shared that in my boys' high school, my son is already in 10th grade, so my children all went to Makor Chayim, which is a high school I really am very, very fond of. In Makor Chayim, they have a 2-3 hours a week on Tuesday, which is their Chesed slot. And during that slot, you can perform Chesed. Or if you want, you can spend 2 or 3 hours that week with your grandparents in Yerushalayim. And what do you have to do with your grandparents in Yerushalayim? Learn Torah, if you want, or you can go to a restaurant. What do you do with your grandparents? Go to development towns and play games with the Ethiopians? Or you could just walk in the park and talk to your grandparents. That's so right. It's so obvious that you can get so much from these relationships and so much tradition, a sense of tradition. We're trying to give you a sense of tradition. And how do you get a sense of tradition? You go back one generation, not just your parents, but it's something larger than your parents with whom sometimes there's antagonism and conflict and strife. So I don't know what we're talking about, but whatever we were talking about, yeah. Kivud Avayim. Okay. So Chazal visit this man called Dama ben Nesina. Thank you. I said Dama ben Nesina, who lives in Ashkelon. And Dama ben Nesina discovered these huge, huge diamond gemstones that were necessary for Big Day Kahuna. The Big Day Kahuna were very, very bejeweled. And all these gems and diamonds on the breastplate, but those are easy to come by. A diamond here, a stone there. But these two huge shoulder junk. Can you imagine putting this huge slab of diamond on one shoulder or some gem and some other? It's hard to find in the desert. Well, they weren't in the desert. It's Chazal. So they visit Dama ben Nesina in Eretz Yisrael. He's got these huge gemstones. They're ready to cut him a check for who knows, a couple cool million. Mucho dinero. They're ready to fork it over. And Dama says, I got to tell you, I can't. You guys all know the famous reason why. Why? Because the gems are in the safe, and the safe has a key, and Daddy's sleeping on the key, and I don't want to wake up Daddy. So first of all, I want to stop writing notes, okay? This is the only time I will say this year to you guys. And I speak on behalf of all of your parents. If this ever happens, don't follow the Gemara, okay? Wake us up. Can't wake my father. If someone comes by your house, got a lot of money for you, for your dad, trust me, your parents want you to wake them up. You wake us up anyway for stupid things. All of a sudden, such a big sign, not going to wake up my father. I'm going to see the sign out to wake up. Like, we don't know what his father said. It's like, they woke up their father. Are you crazy? You're not waking me up? Wake me up! Just take the key, I'll go back to sleep. But anyway, Dama ben Nesina had such kibud eva in for his father, he wanted to wake his father up, and he sacrificed the 5 mil. Well, who knows the end of the story? The next year, there's a Gemara in Kiddushin. What was his reward? Parduma. Now the Chum come back. And now they've got five treasures, 5 chests of silver. It's not just Avnei Shoam money, 5 mil. Now it's astronomic. Now it's 10 mil. Paraduma? What'd you pay for a Paraduma? There's no price. Name your price. Whatever you name. Write your ticket. Write your check. Sign your contract. I'll just sign on the dotted line. Paraduma, once in a blue moon, once in 50 years to find a Paraduma. So what does Dama say? This part of the Gemara no one knows. Dama looks at these Chachamim and says, look, I know that I could ask you for Paraduma money and you'd have to give it to me, but I don't want Paraduma money. Just give me the money I lost last year. Pay me back for last year. Last year I lost 5 million for Kibbutz Avayim. I want that money. Paraduma money, I'm not interested in. Kibbutz Avayim money, I'll take.
which is a lot less, because last year he lost 5 million to keep it away, not the 15 million for the pardon. What's the purpose of the story? What's Dhamma saying? It sounds strange. Why did he want the money? Why is he more even recording some loser named Dhamma ben Nisina who forwent or forfeited all this money? What's the purpose of the Gemara? So Ramital explained as follows. Dhamma ben Nisina was an honest guy. He didn't want money that he couldn't identify with or believe in. He says, look, I'm a religious person. As far as I'm concerned, you know what composes my religion? Rituals and experiences I can understand. I get Kippur Avayim. I was a Kippur Avayim hero last year. I lost money. I deserve that money because I committed, I was devoted to a mitzvah, or to a, not a mitzvah for a guy, but a concept and a responsibility that I get. So I deserve the Kippur Avayim money that I blew last year. Kippur Avayim. Paraduma. Paraduma is illogical. Paraduma makes no sense. It's irrational. I don't feel right taking money for paraduma. I don't feel right selling you a paraduma. There's no place in my religious ecosystem. I'll take Kippur Avayim money. Paraduma money, I'm too honest for that. Keep it. Take the paraduma. Just pay me the Kippur Avayim that I deserve because I was religiously motivated last year. Paraduma is the quintessential chok. It's not just irrational. Listen to what I'm about to say. What sense does it make? Ashes and water and pouring and red and hair and did work. It did make any sense. But it's a quintessential hope. Why? Because it reminds us that not everything in life will make sense. And you have to have the capacity to succeed religiously even when it doesn't make sense. That's why the paradigmatic, quintessential, prototypical, classic, epitome chok relieves death. Because death is the door we can't open, is the one experience in human life that we just have no answers for. And when we hit up with death and we suffer the impurity of death, we need God's logic, not human logic, to descend into assist us and to repair us from death, because it's not something we have any answers for. What do you think? Is it just incidental? Is it just arbitrary that the classic chok is about solving death? No, it's a message. Death is a metaphor. Death and other parts of life that you just won't have answers for. Can you build a religion that's a blend of two? Or are you like Dhamma ben Nisina, that the only religion that you can weave is one that's logical and rational and empirical? And you see, paraduma is not just irrational, it's also enigmatic, and those are not synonyms, they're very different. It's irrational, makes no sense, but sometimes irrational systems are consistent. They don't make sense, but there's a consistency. Paraduma is not just irrational, it's inconsistent. It's ironic. What's the irony of paraduma? What's the inconsistency of paraduma? I don't know. It doesn't make sense, but at least let it be consistent. What's the inconsistency? What's the incongruity? No? Going becomes time. So it's ironic. It's antithetical. Not just is it irrational, but the system is backwards. It's pretzels. It's life is illogical sometimes. But not just is it illogical, sometimes it's ironic. And sometimes it's inconsistent. And sometimes even when you suffer, it doesn't make sense. And even when things don't make sense to you, they don't even have inner logic to them, even though the system itself is illogical. And that's why in Mara it becomes crucial for them to experiment, not just with logical, rational, foundational, seminal, meaningful, symbolic mitzvahs, but try this one for size. They didn't burn any cows, they didn't have a mishkan. They studied the laws of paraduma. Because they had to be prepared for Har Sinai. And this was a mentality adjustment. This was a mind shaper. You're going to stand at Har Sinai and beyond Har Sinai. And you're going to find answers to a lot of things. And you're going to understand a lot of mitzvahs. And you're going to understand not just mitzvahs, a lot of your life you'll understand. I promise you, you'll all get the parts of your life you just won't understand. Why is it happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Why this mitzvah? What is happening to the Jewish people? Why is this happening in Israel? You see, your generation, our generation, has become a one-trick pony. And that one trick won't succeed in life. Rational. Doesn't make sense. have to make sense to me. I don't understand that. I don't yet understand. It doesn't coincide with my view. I can't see two things that happened. We're ultra hyper scientific because we live in the tail end of this incredible scientific revolution, spanning hundreds of years, in which we've uncovered the reasons for everything. So we become addicted to reason, we become addicted to ration. Turn the clock back 500 years, very little made sense in the world. The world's full of mystery, full of the unknown, full of the illogical. And people live with a more balanced diet of logic and illogic, of ration and irration. You operate in a world that didn't always make sense to you. So it's perfectly natural to perform mitzvahs that didn't make sense to you. The second part that's fallen apart is trust. We suffer a crisis of trust. It's hard to trust. And you're able to accept ideas and practices that don't make sense when you trust the person purveying them and delivering them. And it's so hard to trust. When all the allegations and the sexual abuse and the political scandals and the financial corruption, they're all local crimes and they all have terrible, terrible legacies of victimhood. And there's not enough I can say about them. And I'm not going to start because my heart will pour open with sadness and tragedy. Literally, when I talk about it, I start to cry. Think about lives who are shattered. But the common denominator between all of them is that they sow and they create an environment of distrust. And sadly enough, when you read about the directives and the guidelines being given now by teachers to kids and parents to kids and parents to teachers and all the guidelines now that every institution, don't trust anyone just because they're a trusted leader, and don't trust, and of course you can't trust anyone that takes advantage or chas v'chalila invades your physical private area or chas v'shalom, of course, but the end game of all this is going to be we're creating a world with no trust whatsoever, and that is not a world of religious success. And it's crucial that our messages be blended messages. Don't trust when people are not deserving of your trust or abuse that trust or manipulate that trust, but God forbid, you have to trust. You have to find people in this world whom you trust, and you have to learn how to build trust. Trust is the currency of relationships. The relationships you value in life are the people whom you trust deeply to be there, to show up, to serve you, to inspire you. You trust the ideas that they're delivering to you. If we build a culture of distrust, we're signing the death warrant of tradition and of religion, and it has to be a very, very nuanced messages. The greatest failures of communities are the failures of overreaction. And we are now perched on a precipice of overreaction. Not to say that we're overreacting. I'm just saying we have to be careful not to overreact. It doesn't mean, God forbid, to minimize or dismiss or ignore allegations. It means when we're creating cultural calibration into how we build our communities and our worlds and our guidelines, not, God forbid, to overreact and to create a world in which no one can trust anyone else, because otherwise we are endangering religion. So if you don't trust people to deliver ideas you can't make sense of on your own, and your sole benchmark or yardstick for meaning is what makes sense to you, you're going to live a very, very lonely and unsuccessful religious life. I can't say it any other way. You cannot prove Har Sinai, and you cannot prove Nevuah, and you cannot prove Geula. You have to find people you can trust. When I boil down my religious system, it's because I met someone like Rav Lichtenstein and I trust him with my life. And I met someone like Rav Amital and I trust him with my life. And I met my father, obviously, and I trust him with my life. And I met my grandfather and I trust him. And I've got 10 images in my world of people that I deeply, deeply trust. And therefore, I can buy into the ideas that they deliver to me and start to find ways to personalize them and find my own meaning. But at the end, whether my meaning is more successful or less successful, I've invested in those ideas because I trust the people, and I don't have to employ my logic or my empirical capabilities as the final yardstick for validity or authenticity. So that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was pleading with him. Try on paradum. It's not going to make sense. And even when mitzvahs make sense, can you perform them not because they make sense, because they don't make sense? It sounds a little weird, right? Well, it's not so weird if you're in the 12th century and the Rambam is writing a sefer called Sefer HaMitzvos, and he's delineating reasons for mitzvos, and that decision is causing a huge, huge uproar, huge public outrage. Rambam, how could you dare describe Tamei HaMitzvos? Are you crazy? Of course we won't Tamei HaMitzvos. Why else should we serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Well, part of the outrage was because of the types of reasons the Rambam suggested, because he pinned them to particular sociological context. Don't put on shatnez because there was a cult of monks who wore shatnez. We don't want to be like those monks. And don't drink blood because the paganists drank blood. And don't... And people were worried, what will happen 500 years from now where no monks ever wear shatnez and no paganists ever drink blood, so people will discard the mitzvot. So they were concerned that the Rambam was contextualizing mitzvot rather than asserting their eternal timeless value. But some of the opposition to the Rambam went much deeper. Why should you serve Hashem? Why should you perform a mitzvah? Is there more depth and intensity and devotion if you understand what you're doing? Or if you have no clue what you're doing, and you're serving because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told you? I want to give you a bracha. There are 40 people in this room. How many of you will have this bracha to serve and sell? Some of you will have the bracha. Some of you will have to wait for future generations to have that bracha. The bracha. First time in thousands of years to serve in the Jewish army, to protect our land. Kadosh, 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 the kedusha of a Jewish soldier. Some of you will have that schus. Some of you won't. For those that will have the schus, it's going to have to wait 3 months. Because before the schus begins, there's something called tironut. And tironut doesn't really feel like a schus, trust me. Tironut is basic training. And tironut, you sell your soul to your merfakeh. You don't breathe, scratch your eyebrow, drink water, go to the bathroom, or even look at anything without asking permission. That's how hard it is. So it's a big schus after tironut. Now, why is tironut so important? And you know what makes tironut so hard? It's not just that it's so physically overbearing, but it's psychologically ridiculous. What? You're telling me to chirp like a bird because you told me, or to run across this hilltop 7 times? Doesn't make any sense. And you know what the mefaked will tell you if you ask him? First of all, I don't have to answer that question. But if you're looking for the answer, he'll say, that's precisely the point. I'm instructing you to do senseless things because I'm trying to build something called discipline. If I tell you to eat New Delhi, you're not doing it because of me. You're doing it because you like New Delhi. But if I tell you to eat mud, then there's no reason to eat mud. Okay, that could be physically dangerous until you eat mud. When I tell you to run 15 times in the dark of the night across a hilltop for no apparent reason, you know why you're doing it? Because I said so. And I'm building discipline. And when you're in the heat of the battle, you're going to need that discipline to fall back on. You're going to need to know that you obey my commands because I'm considering the entire unit and the entire situation. I'm seeing things you're not seeing, and I'm concerned that your safety won't be. And you can say, wow, my instructor, bullets are flying, and the terrorists are attacking. My instructor gave me a command. Does it make sense? Does that make sense? Let me sit there and think about it. You'll get yourself killed. You'll get me killed, and the fuck it will tell you. You'll get 5 of your friends killed. You do what I tell you. Because at this point, discipline is absolutely vital for any functioning army. And I have to build that discipline over 3 months of senseless commands. So how do you build discipline? HaKadosh Baruch Hu? By understanding the mitzvahs? Or by not understanding the mitzvahs? And of course the answer is understanding the mitzvahs. And of course much of our Masar has agreed with the Rambam, not like Hasidus, it didn't. But when you're doing a mitzvah, are you aware of layers and say, I understand the reason of the mitzvah, I understand the purpose, and I understand, but is there something, here's a key word, I've waited so many months to introduce this. I'm going to say this word again and again and again and again and again throughout the year. It's called transcendence. There's something that transcends me and my mind and my world and my social and my society. And I can't just turn Shabbos into a feel-good weekend of pajamas and shalit and board games. There's a transcendence to Shabbos. I'm leaping into a new realm. I'm going beyond myself, higher than, beyond them. The next level, somewhere outside my little world, which feels so big, but really is big and little at the same time. And can I say, well, there are reasons for this mitzvah, but you know what? I am now embarking on a journey on an experience into a different realm, and I won't know all the reasons and layers to the mitzvah. So I'll savor the reasons, and I'll personalize the mitzvah by internalizing the reasons, but there's so much more. Who knows what it means to put on tefillin? And who knows what it means to take a lulav? And who knows what it means to eat matzah? So I'll translate into my world, but that won't be the sole benchmark of experience. There'll be something beyond, and the mitzvah serves as a gateway to something beyond. So to get to that beyond, Hashem has to give them a mitzvah that they can never understand. You will not understand Paraduma. Greater people than you will try to understand it. Shlomo HaMelech will try to decode it. He won't get it. Moshe will try. He won't get it. No one will get it. Can you be an Oved Hashem? Well, you don't get it. And until you pass that test, Har Sinai can't happen. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers Paraduma to us in Mara. And that's what that Gentile just didn't get. When you think about world religions, and I mean world religions over the span of world religion, more or less, religions were binary and exclusive. Either they were solely pitched on the irrational and the mysterious, more or less the world of paganism, the world of black magic, soothsayers, that ancient world. And then there's a pendulum swing towards hyper-rational, what makes sense to me? Religions that make sense to me. You're going to say tomorrow in davening, those of you who have the schus to come to davening, Chukav u'mishpatav li'Yisrael lo asachen l'chogai. Chukav u'mishpatav li'Yisrael. It's the blend of chok u'mishpat. It's the blend of Parshas B'Shalach. It's the blend of Mara. Chukav u'mishpatav li'Yisrael lo asachen l'chogai. Non-Jews have found religious meaning, but it's always been stilted towards one. Now, Kadosh Baruch Hu is asking us in Mara, and I'm asking you as you start to build your life, a little bit of each. A little bit of each. Things you understand, things, not just with mitzvahs, about life. You'll understand parts of life, you won't get parts of life. It's a process, it's a blend. It's called intellectual humility. If your mind and your empirical capacity is the yardstick, it's a little bit egotistical. Well, your mind is limited, it's a tool. Use it, sharpen it. No one's going to accuse this yeshiva. And I hope no one's going to accuse me of not placing great emphasis on intellectual analysis and sharpening your mind and building the tools. But it's a tool. It's not the core of identity. It's not the sole yardstick. Walk away from that. You live in a concrete prison of empiricism. And if you're jailed in that prison, you will not find meaning. You will not find faith. Don't fall into that trap. Use it. Understand it. But that can't be the final word. There has to be something deeper and more basic that you fall upon when you can't explain something. And you have to have the ability to continue to serve HaKadosh Baruch. I don't know what this means. It doesn't make sense to me. It's hard for me. My mind isn't there yet, nor may my mind ever get there. But I'm not after the Kadosh Baruch Hu. I'm so desperate to give you that balance. Again, it's easy. And now that you're halfway through your year or more, you realize that every message in this room, and almost every message in this yeshiva, is a balanced message. It is very easy for me to slam, not easy, but if I tried to, I could probably slam my fist on the table and rail against cognition and rail against empiricism and rail against understanding and provide a one-sided message. And you don't drink the Kool-Aid because I'm a pretty good speaker. Yeah, in 5 years from now, what would that be worth? Because it won't stand the test of reality. It's not that the world you live in. For these messages to be enduring, they have to reflect the complexity of life and the complexity of our world. And complexity means calibration. It's moving the cursor. And everyone moves the cursor between low and bright, between loud and soft, between high density. It's always moving the cursor between two. Too much light, you won't see the screen. Too little light, you won't see the screen. Too loud, you won't hear the music. Too low, you won't hear the music. Move the cursor. Build the calibration. Understand. Analyze, personalize, make sense, uncover meaning. There's nothing greater than that. The road to personalization is comprehension. If you understand something, then you will live it more deeply. It should be obvious to you. But the road to success is a blend and a merging of the two, of Avodas Hashem. Okay, since we typically are at our 5 minute, 7 minute, we have to leave point, I'll just mention something very, very quickly. Okay? Let me tell you a story. I learned a lot watching Rav Aaron Lichtenstein at weddings. And when I watch Rav Aaron Lichtenstein at weddings, I was reminded in part of Parshas B'Shalach. No one's getting married in Parshas B'Shalach. There's no weddings. So what reminded me? Well, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would do two things at weddings. And I try as best as I can, in my own small, fallen, failed way, to just live up to that standard. Number one, you know, the Rosh Hashiva and the Rebbe comes, and you dance a little bit, and, you know, you dance in the beginning, and then at some point, 10 minutes after the family dances, they pull the Rosh Hashiva into the middle, and he dances, and then he goes home. Or Rav Aaron Lichtenstein danced from the opening whistle to the final bell with every ounce of his energy. If I'm here at a wedding, I'm here to bring Simcha Chasen Kala. What greater Simcha for the Chasen Kala than the Gadol Hador dancing like a banjo dog with every ounce of his energy for a full hour? And I saw this when he was in his advanced age with his hip problems. You come and you dance. You're not there to eat. You're not there to clap on the side. You're there to dance. You're there to make as much Simcha as you can. Now, this is not an important message for you at the age of 18 or 24 because you love dancing. So store it away for when you're 35 and you'd rather just sit there and eat in the wedding and do your symbolic dancing. And you come and you dance every single day. Right now you love dance. I don't tell you to dance every time. I don't tell you to dance. One day. Start away. You don't come to weddings to eat. The eating is the side part. You don't come to weddings to hobnob. Come to weddings to Simcha Chasen Kala. And when it's Simcha Chasen Kala, during the, obviously you give a gift, and obviously the other way is Simcha Chasen Kala, but the dancing is what you're there for. And then they finally blew the whistle for intermission. Okay, everyone's hustling back to their chairs, getting the food, waving at the crowd, talking to the important people. Where's Rav Aaron Lichtenstein? Oh, he's over there in the corner talking to the Bubby and the Zadie. Why is he talking to the Bubby and the Zadie? Let me tell you who gets lost in the wedding. It's the Bubby and the Zadie. Because weddings move quickly. From chuppah to shmorg to dancing. Loud. People. Movement. Yeah, older people have a hard time with it. I don't know if you've been at weddings. I don't know if you've been at weddings with older people in wheelchairs or with canes or with walkers or struggling to keep up. You know, they walk down the aisle and the wedding continues without them because there's a fast pace. Everybody's breakneck. They're not in the middle. Maybe they bring the Zadie into the middle for, again, his symbolic dance. And then he's off on the side and everyone's moving around. And there's Rav Aaron spending an hour talking to Bubby. We're talking to Zadie. Or talking to another older person in the crowd who no one's really paying attention to. And not through any fault of anyone's own, just too much energy, too much euphoria, too much excitement, breakneck speed. Too much, everyone's happening. And I watched. And I tried to learn the following. You will find yourself sometimes in swirls, large situations with a lot of energy and a lot of people and a lot of excitement and a lot of things to see and a lot of razzle dazzle. Can you pay attention and respect to individuals, specifically in those moments when there's a lot happening around you? Or do you lose sight of individuals? Vayikach Moshe asas Mos Yosef imo ki hashbe hashbi as b'nei Yisrael pakov yifgod olokim eschem v'halisem esas mosan yizem. Man, Moshe had a lot on his plate that day. 3.5 million people are scurrying around Egypt, finding cattle, food, carts, wagons, sticks, Egyptian. And he has the super, he's the conductor of this whole symphony. And he's got Paro chasing him down. And couldn't he just ask someone to take care of Yosef's bones? He's not even from Shevet Yosef. He's all Levi. Find some Yosef guy. Find a Josephian. No, Levi. Levi, find someone named Joseph. Maybe at least his name is Joseph. At least find someone whose name is Yosef. My name is Moshe. I'm not from Shevet Levi. I don't even have that name. That's the profile of Moshe at the start of his career. There's a dead man in a coffin who can't speak for himself, and he needs someone to speak for him. And I will honor that commitment. And I will look at a person, and I won't look through a person just because there's so much else happening. It's really sad that I don't really have too much time to explain this and articulate this because it's a really important point, and you know the difference. As you grow older, you'll see. It is really easy in large-scale environments and big situations with a lot of energy and people and excitement and weddings and people I never want this to come across as if chas v'shalom I'm aggrandizing. I just want to try to make it personal what I try to do. Don't always succeed. But I want you to know how I try to live these messages as best I can. Sometimes when I speak in public, in large settings, so there are a lot of people who come over for comments, yashikoach, introduce themselves, and sure, you know, when someone speaks, there's 20 people that come over. It'd be very easy to just do the Michael Jordan, you know, shake this one's hand, turn this one, a quick brief moment there, a quick brief second there. And if a person comes out, I try to give that person and the people with them my full attention. Even if it means I try not to be rude to people waiting, but I can't favor someone waiting at these, unless the person's an important person, won't be insulted. But I remember once, there's an old woman who came, I think it was in Australia or something. They're like, Mincha Marv, the speech or something, an old woman came and shared her ideas with me, or she had some family connection with me, and everyone, Davini, I'm telling you, I'll miss Baruch Hu. Like, it's obvious to me. I'll miss Baruch Hu. I'll show this woman some respect. Okay, so that, I didn't say it in a disrespectful way. Just, I'll get there. And if they start without me, start without me. What's true about Tzibor is more important than, you know, crushing a person's heart. Just last night, I wrote an article, wrote an article last week about the Waldo. You may have read it. It was in a lot of newspapers. And a woman wrote a letter to the newspaper, and she took away from the article very different intentions than mine. I wrote a letter of clarification, a very respectful letter to her, and I wrote a letter back to the newspaper. I said, it's only mentioned to share it with you first before it gets published in the newspaper. Her opening paragraph was so heartwarming. I was so gratified. I took the time. She said, you know, I very often write letters to the editor against, commenting and editing people's, not editing, but commenting or arguing or whatever, people. And I normally get shot down by men on social media who make me feel humiliated when I voice it. I feel it's just not worth it. Like, she was basically, I wrote it such a respectful letter. I said, dear whatever, thank you for saying, I totally agree with this or whatever. Just try to be respectful. I gave the person dignity. The thought that a woman, I don't know if she's older or not, but the thought that a woman would feel that she can't express her voice in social media because bully males come and she, how dare you? How dare you bully anyone? How dare you bully a woman? How dare you bully an old woman? Chas v'shalom. Whatever Torah that person learned, whatever values that person's expressing are toxic. It's your utmost respect to people and to older people, and that a woman feels that she can't voice her opinion because she's going to be bullied and silenced. Of course you miss davening. These are messages that I don't know how relevant they are right now, but you'll feel them and you'll start to planting seeds, and maybe 20 years from now something will go off in your mind and say, I heard that before. I'm going to pay attention to people and shower them with attention and respect and not lose sight. Sometimes, to be honest, I feel like people, when they're talking to me in a public setting, they're looking through me. They're not really looking at me. They're scanning the crowd, waving to people, looking at others. Give people your entire essence, your mindfulness. Look at them, talk to them, pay attention to them. Don't lose focus and don't lose attentiveness and don't lose respect because you're distracted about other things. That person is in your world right now. Give them as much attention, as much of your focused energy as you can. Okay, let's stop it.